I think the increasing awareness around the importance of regional culture, I think things are going to start turning toward staying put and doing the work, you know, where the original community was, where you found your voice. And again, as with anything in music industry, there's just no right way of doing it. It's too nuanced.
That's Ted Hudson. I'm Steve Cleveland. This is Sync Club. Hey, Ted, welcome to the club. You've kind of had an interesting start. So could you give us like just a little background on what got you started in the business? And because it's kind of trippy, actually.
Yeah, it's weird. So I started out, I'll just go back to just after college. So my friend Alex Deason and I started a band after we graduated from college down in Brooklyn called the Damwells. And we were really lucky, worked really hard. And we were a band in New York at the time of the Strokes and countless other New York bands. But it was a pretty fertile environment for labels to be signing artists. And we were fortunate in many regards. We got in with a good manager. We got in with friends in the industry, people who become very close friends in the industry, who held our hands through all these processes and all of our fear and outrage and everything else that comes with learning that music is, you know, a business, mm-hmm. As well as an art. And so from there, we had lots and lots of opportunities, but along the way, we got to tour with The Fray right after we got dropped by Epic. and they were still on Epic, of course. You know, we had fairly, let's say, divergent career paths. Okay. But they were just such great guys. They said, you know, we don't care if they got dropped. We want to tour with them anyway. That's how I got to know Ben. Is the drummer from The Fray. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, strange thing about that. Ben grew up in the neighborhood by my mother's house.
Oh, no way.
Two houses down.
Right.
Kind of one of those funny things, but The Fray did very well for themselves here in Denver, you know.
Yeah, they really. Oh, yeah, in the world, exactly. So that becomes important to color a real story later on. So we toured with them, had a great time, did a lot of things away. Some of them regrettable, some of them not. But eventually, as these things go, typically it all ends in tears. And so I needed to take stock of where I was in life and what my goals were. And so I got lucky again, and through a friend of my family and a friend of mine, Chris Dixon, threw me a bone and gave me a shot in the startup world in New York. And I was fortunate enough to work with him in a really great team in an industry that I wasn't very familiar with, which is the tech startup world. And, you know, he gave me a really great opportunity there. I worked there for a while and then moved to a different startup with a friend who I had met at Punch, which was the company with Chris Dixon. And then that was called Milewise. Mm. And I was doing that simultaneous to working at HBO. Which honestly kind of fell in my lap. Again, you know, through connections and networking, I was able to get some interviews there. I started in the temp pool and then got an interview in the music licensing department. Mm-hmm. And probably my most fortunate stroke of luck was that a brilliant mind in the music business, Michael Hallett, was working there. He was the VP of music licensing at HBO at the time. And he really took me under his wing. He was an amazing teacher, a very generous person with his experience and intellect. And a very patient guy as well. I have benefited greatly throughout my life from the generosity of intellect from great people.
You've probably picked up on this, but it's probably something that you're doing that makes people want to work with you and share their knowledge, because
I can't figure it out. It might be. It might also just be right. A good, solid Ohio upbringing.
Hey, you know, that's probably the thing. Yeah, well, you know, just to kind of step back, it was like looking at some of the folks that you get to play with.
Mm-hmm.
Like too high of regard for.
I get it.
You know, it's like, Robin Zander, you're kidding me.
Oh, I know. That was so intimidating. But they, those guys, yeah. So my band, when we were touring, we like right away, through Silent Partner Management, which was our first management company, and Wes Kidd, Dave Fry, they also managed Cheap Trick. So they put us on tour with them. And it ended up being a really great combination. And there again, Cheap Trick was very generous and took us out quite a few times. And like, you know, we got to do cool stuff, but it, I was totally intimidated by those guys.
Well, I would be too. I can appreciate that. But you know, at the same time, it's like, it's just, it's, I guess they're just people, right? And some people are cool and some people aren't.
So. Oh yeah. No. And they, right. And they weren't intimidating, but who they were, you know, the characters of who they were intimidating. Them as people, they were incredibly kind and generous. And, you know, Rick Nielsen came out and bought one of our CDs on stage the first night that we played with them. You know what I mean? It was just, they didn't have to do that. You know, most headliners don't even pay attention to the opening band, much less actively promote them on stage. It was amazing.
That is so cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And all those guys were great.
Yeah. Rick Nielsen, you know, in addition to being just all around cool guy, you know, decent guitar player.
Yeah. A little bit. You know, pretty good songwriter too.
Yeah. Right. Right. So, well, hey, so this venture in HBO, I'm kind of fascinated by that, because at that point you're kind of a buyer of music.
Mm-hmm.
Does that give you an advantage in your current role?
Yeah, I see where you're going. And that's definitely true. Again, I worked with Michael Houghton at the time, and Lauren Miola, Suzanne Glickman, you know, just some really, really great people at HBO, who are, many of whom are still there. And they came from different aspects of the industry as well. You know, there again, everybody just was so happy and generous to teach me all these things. But they brought to my library of knowledge all the experiences that they had on the publishing side and on the master side. So I, you know, just kind of paid attention, I guess, and got the insight from not only the network where I was, which, as you said, did the purchasing of licenses and negotiation of licenses,
mm-hmm.
specifically for placement in TV and promo, and then also publishing and master stuff. So that has given me, you know, a lot of, I would say, experience by proxy or sort of trickle down experience,
okay.
which has informed my ability to kind of be an effective advisor
mm-hmm.
for Color Wheel. And then that combined with Ben's experience in the fray, Sean King's experience in Davochka, and the lots of licenses that those guys have gone through, and Jeff Linsenmeyer and his experience as a producer, as a composer, and as a band member in really big bands, and just his talent, you know.
Yeah.
I can't occupy those other spaces, but I do have confidence in my ability to show up with the insight that I gained at HBO.
Gotcha. So you were in New York at the time when you were with HBO. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, for placement, are there advantages of being in LA or Nashville or New York, or is that something that you can do in flyover country
in the middle
like
of the
Denver,
country?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the quick answer is yes. And that's evidenced by the fact that, I mean, Color Wheel is doing well, and there are other companies, not just in Denver, but all over the Midwest that do this. So I would say, yeah, the more nuanced answer is it's absolutely an advantage if you can live in New York or Nashville or LA on certain levels. Like there's just so much work there, because in LA you have TV and movies, production houses, tons of ad agencies, other music licensing houses, as well as much bigger pools of composer communities and, you know, easier access to studios. And because there are more of those things, they tend to be a little bit more cost effective. So if you need a studio in LA, you've got a much more competitive environment, so that, you know, your studio cost might be lower in those places.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. That said, there, because of the digital revolution and because recording has become so cheap, if not free, like you get for free, you get GarageBand on a Mac, and that's good enough to record at least demos, you know. So you can submit things that you've recorded for free from anywhere, and you don't necessarily need to be in LA or New York or Nashville to attain an edge and work with the producers and editors and agencies who are headquartered in those places.
Sure. That makes sense.
So I don't think it's necessary, but I do think that it is still a little bit of an advantage, just because it's easier to, if you're motivated, it's easier to walk up to an agency and introduce yourself.
Right.
And FaceTime is still pretty valuable.
Talking to somebody instead of, you know, just through email or electronic means.
Yeah. But it's becoming less and less of an advantage, I think, over time. And so you're going to see these more regional markets start to develop their own internal industries. And you'll see a little less, I think, in New York and LA and Nashville, which isn't to say they're going to, you know, become irrelevant or something. They're always going to be the big players.
Sure.
But there's more room, I think, now for markets surrounding, you know, Omaha and Denver and Minnesota or Minneapolis.
It's possible that the world, you know, they say like the internet has really made the world a much smaller place because everybody's connected. I don't know if that's actually true or not, but you know, on TV. So things have definitely changed.
Definitely. And, you know, I just want to say also that there are disadvantages of living in you know, New York and LA and Nashville, the most obvious.
Oh, okay. So now this is good, because this is what I wasn't expecting. So let's hear this.
So, well, the most obvious disadvantage of living in those places is the cost of living. You know, Denver has become more expensive, I would say, for a lot of neighborhoods in LA. It's comparable at this point. Mm-hmm. But the cost of living outside of just rent is higher out there. And so it's a little harder to make your ends meet in LA than it is in a Denver or a Minneapolis or, you know, Omaha or mm-hmm. Des Moines, you know, for example. So you have to work a lot harder out there to keep income rolling in, or you might have to work another job, you know, in order to cover your expenses. And all of that takes away from your effectiveness as, you know, a composer.
Right.
So, yeah. And then outside of that, there's a huge population of musicians and artists, and everybody's got buckets of hustle, and it's harder to shine in an environment like that. It's harder to separate yourself or distinguish yourself from the rest of the population when it's that saturated.
Yeah, I get that.
Cool.
It's like in the middle of Hollywood, right? So it's like, so, you know, you show up and he's like, well, this is very touristy. But then, like, as soon as I got out of the Uber, I was like, oh my God, I felt this, like, I'm among my people. It was just the weirdest thing because, you know, there was like 2,000 people there that all were like me, you know, at some level. You know, LA is not going to be like that every day, or maybe it is, but if it is, it's awesome. But, you know,
it kind of is.
It's just like a collection of people like me. It's like, God, it just feels good to be like, you know, where everybody's interested in the same thing. And so everybody's pretty much cool. And, you know, it's like nicest people that you could ever hope to run into.
Yeah. There's a great community, obviously a huge community out in LA. And you're right. You will always run into, if you're lucky enough to get into those circles, you'll run into a lot of people who are willing to help. Now, that's true in other places as well. It's just that there isn't as big of a pool. And it's one of these kind of rich get richer scenarios where if we all are willing to program ourselves for legitimate reasons as well as just emotional reasons, that in order to make it, and those were air quotes, you have to go to LA or New York or Nashville, you know, that's where everything, then those places will continue to always completely dominate, the national landscape and therefore opportunities to be found. So it sort of becomes this feedback loop. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's very healthy, because if you're an artist from, let's say, Minneapolis, or, you know, let's pick a different city, Columbus, Ohio, and you have, you know, developed as much as you think that you can in Columbus, and you end up moving to LA or New York or Nashville, you inevitably assimilate into those cultures. And so one of the costs of that is that you lose some of what made you special. that sounds a little dire, but some of the culture that you were imbued with as a result of being from Columbus, Ohio, and being part of that music community, you know, inevitably diminishes over time. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just something to consider, you know, rather than doing the work and developing some of these smaller, relatively smaller markets, were, I think, a little too quick to just move to Nashville and, you know, swing really hard there, or move to LA and swing really hard there, and just and then you know, Columbus, Ohio doesn't get, or, you know, loses something, you know, when you leave and make your career elsewhere.
Right.
So I think it's a harder row to hoe. But I think given the opportunities afforded us by technology, and I think the increasing awareness around the importance of regional culture, I think things are going to start turning toward staying put and doing the work, you know, where the original community was, where you found your voice. And again, as with anything in music industry, there's just no right way of doing it. It's too nuanced. I don't mean to discourage anybody from moving to one of those cities, but I think, you know, I would like to see people focusing more on their home turf, so that we can get away from this nagging model of Nashville, LA, and New York, because there are inevitably going to be things that I can't even anticipate that happen in Columbus, Ohio, you know, that would be different and perhaps a lot more healthy for, you know, the cultural infrastructure of the cities.
I really like that idea of having a more diverse palette of sounds and styles.
And I think there's no way around it. Like you kind of have to be isolated. It's kind of weird, but you see this in culture, you know, in anthropology. In order for one culture to be unique and different, it does kind of need to be a little bit isolated. You need at least a moment of an echo chamber in these places where things can differentiate. And, you know, that's true for music as well.
You know, I don't have quite the argument set up that you do, but I'll buy in. I'm buying in. Let's see. Could I ask you some questions about working with music supervisors?
Sure.
So from the point of view of an independent artist, are there advantages or disadvantages of trying to work directly with a music supervisor? Is it something that you really need to work through an agency with?
Sure. I mean, again, my story was a little different because I started in on the business side of music. I started at HBO, which was like this crazy stroke of luck. But through HBO, I got to know music supervisors, and they're the coolest people.
That's what I've heard.
They're so great. They have just encyclopedic knowledge of music. They're into everything. They can, like, your least favorite band, they will describe in such a way that you will suddenly now love that band. You know, like, oh, I never thought of it that way. Yeah, they're just special people. So with that knowledge, like, I would say, if you have the opportunity to work directly with the music supervisor, do it. It may not be, at least initially, clear how that's relevant to your career, but because they may not be able to get you into the programs and projects that they're working on, you know, because they have their set of marching orders, and, you know, you may not fit the bill. But at the very least, having conversations, and, you know, you could help yourself to apply your craft in a vocational way by, you know, learning what the trends are and learning what sorts of things are being licensed a lot. And then you can go back to your studio and you have your own artistic voice and your own thing that you're doing, but you can also apply your art in a more vocational way and just say, okay, cool, I'm giving myself an assignment. This isn't something that I would normally compose, but I'm going to do it and see what happens. And you may discover that you're super good at some things that you were too afraid to try, frankly, or you considered inauthentic, or all these really toxic words that prevent us from trying new things. You know, it's, I grew up in, I came up in the 90s, you know, and the, like, if you weren't authentic, then you were like, like a sellout. There was so much judgment around that stuff. And so we constantly
be a poser.
Yeah, poser. I mean, it was awful and like really limiting. It's like, okay, well, then who am I supposed to sound? You got to sound like you. Okay. That's not helping.
That's going to happen, right? I mean, it seems like it's impossible to sound like somebody else. I've tried.
Yeah.
It's like you always come out, right?
Right. So people would just paralyze themselves by trying to be authentic when they ended up trying to be something other than who they actually were because they were chasing some authenticity that was just, you know, was going to be there regardless. So it becomes an obstacle. But anyway, so that's all by way of saying you can work on projects with music supervisors, even if you're not on one of their gigs, and just learn a bit more about how to compose for that milieu. So yeah, I would definitely encourage it if you can, you know, and it's not easy to meet those people.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, they have to keep somewhat.
Well, they're just busy. They're just very, very busy. And most music supervisors, you know, work on just strict licensing projects. And so they're working from catalogs that they get from publishers and master rights holders. And then their own massive repositories of music. It's really cool. If you ever get a chance, you know, get together with a music supervisor and just ask them to make you like a playlist. It's the amount of cool music that they have is incredible. Yeah.
That'd be cool. Yeah. So we're going to continue the conversation with Ted next week. This is Steve Cleveland, and you've been listening to Sync Club. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe. Hey, thanks for the hang. We'll see you here next week at the club.